Thank you, and I'm Steve Benson, back with regular co-host David Feinberg, sculptor and associate professor of studio arts here at the University of Minnesota. And today we're talking with visiting artist John Knutson. John Knutson is a graduate of Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, the University of Iowa, and also has studied and worked around the world, and particularly in a place called Atelier 17 in Paris, which we'll talk a little bit about in the second part of the program. And he has a show in the Studio Arts Building here at the University of Minnesota running through October 21st. Studio Arts Building is open 9 to 4, 6 days a week. And if you'd like to join us, you can call us in this part of the program at 625-5800. That's 625-5800. Outside the metro area, 1-800-247-0785. That's 1-800-247-0785. And outside the state of Minnesota, call us collect at area code 612, then a regular 625-5800 number.
John, you create a lot of symbols in your paintings, such as and play with scale and color and brightness. And I was wondering why you collect rugs. Is that the same fascination in the Caucasian rugs, those antique rugs that you collect?
I collect rugs, and it was purely by accident, because about 8 years ago I totally remodeled or redid my house. I tore all the existing wall-to-wall carpeting, and it's an older house with wood floors. Sanded them down, varnished them, and then I said to my wife, I said, let's buy some Oriental rugs. And, of course, one thing led to another, and I think I've got about 30 or 40 of them. And not all big ones, mind you. Most of them are tribal rugs, and that's particularly what I collect. And since then, of course, I've become president of the Chicago Rug Society, which is a group of people who have common interest in collecting rugs. And I guess what I like about them is that they're every bit as important artistically as painting. You'll find little masterpieces that have been woven out in the plains of Central Asia by nomadic women that have all the earmarks of beautiful art that one might find in a painting and so forth. They're totally anonymous, of course. We don't know who did them, and that's part of the mystery of them. I'm always trying to figure out and think maybe who did this, you know, and what place. And what was she thinking, and what was her background? And it's really a romantic kind of notion that I have about these rugs, but they're wonderfully aesthetically pleasing, and the one thing I like about them is they're tactile. You touch them. That's part of the wool quality of a rug is something I love to. I can almost touch a rug and tell you where it's from.
Now, when you were giving your lecture yesterday, you mentioned that the ones that you like the best are the ones where individualism shows up.
Right.
And even though everything was told to them as a method, not everybody followed that method in terms of making. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I could get off on rugs for hours because it's such a wonderful subject. But a young girl learns weaving from her mother at the age of 3. As soon as she can stand up, she's by 6 or 7, she's a master weaver. And all weaving is done by the women. And she spends her early years making dowry rugs, basically, that she'll bring to her wedding. And these are the best, the most charming. And, of course, in the process of learning weaving, her mother has a whole vocabulary of pattern and designs. And you'll find that there are a lot of rugs that are very repetition, where pattern becomes boring and shows a lack of creativity. But then every once in a while you'll find that artist that exists in a lot of people where they'll change. They'll make slight changes in the patterns that are the vocabulary that she's been taught, and the artist comes out. And so you'll see little mistakes here and there. You'll see areas of a rug maybe that are not symmetrical.
Maybe they're not mistakes. Maybe that's the artist, right?
I have a friend who's a rug dealer, and he calls them mistakes. And I've tried to correct him, but he doesn't see that. To him, perfect rug is a perfect symmetrical rug, and artists know that perfect symmetry is utter boredom. Only man can make something so perfectly symmetrical and be utterly boring, but that real excitement comes in asymmetry, which is what we're talking about. Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that these rugs are made to be used.
Yes.
Most of them are. They're
right.
Not objects to be hung away on walls.
Yeah.
We may do that, but they're used every day.
You don't believe in using them, though, do you?
No.
You have
well,
to repair it from the barbarians that wore them out, right?
A rug is made to be walked on. I think that with due respect, you have to take it in that context. I do have some marvelous pieces on the floor, but I always take my shoes off. And in fact, the nomads did too when they went into the tent, would always take their shoes off. And after years, some of the rugs, like the 100-year-old rugs, the Caucasian rugs that had deep pile, is that walking over rugs makes the wool glossier. And some of the wonderful Kazakh rugs that I've seen, and I have a few too, that the wool is like silk. And that's basically because it's been walked on and has added that luster to the wool and without wearing it down. Now, the rugs that you talk about that have been beat, there are many rugs that come to this country maybe 30, 40 years ago when you could buy a collector's rug for $25. Now, of course, they're very expensive. But people would buy these down, put them down, and, of course, just wear them to the floor.
Furniture and
Very dogs. I've seen rugs with big, like, gigantic dog teeth marks on the side of them. And I've gotten into restoration. I've done two rugs now, restored foundation and repiled. It's nice. It's nice kind of busy work. I enjoy doing it, and I just love rugs, and it's another activity that I've gotten into.
You and in fact have taken all your paintings down.
I've taken all the paintings down in my house and hung rugs up on the walls.
Let me relate that to your etchings, which are wonderfully detailed and incredibly inscribed. I mean, one can spend literally hours in front of one of your etchings and following the details of the windows and the repetition and following the slants of the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Is that like weaving a rug?
Yeah, it is. Thank you. That's a compliment, because I always feel when I go to a museum, a painting says, come over to me and spend some time with me. You know, there's so many paintings that you go to. I mean, I'm not a great fan of Mark Rothko. I mean, I can walk by his paintings and keep going. I don't somehow, it doesn't say to me, come over and ponder me for a while. I guess, and not because paintings are busy does that mean that I want to go over, but I think that's important, that say, hey, come over and spend some time looking at me and get involved in what's happening, and that I feel that's a compliment. When people do that,
you also like to play jokes within your etchings, and there's one that involves birds.
Yes, the big one I've done now it's called a working day, which is a full size sheet of copper, 24 by 36. Which I said I'm just going to do this one big plate, and when I'm done with it, I feel like I've passed one particular mountain peak in my lifetime, it's full of all kinds of little visual things, and I turned 47 at the time I was working on it, so I put 47 birds in there, and sometimes I'll say, well, can you find all the birds, and it's just kind of a little sidelight to the etching. It's by no means the most important thing, but I suppose it's a little bit of whimsy that I've thrown into it. So
now sometimes you appreciate people liking your paintings for the wrong reasons, which a lot of artists get mad at. Like you were telling me, some ladies were looking for some misspelled words in your
The big painting I just talked about is full of misspelled words, and because I'm a lousy speller, and I suppose I could look in the dictionary and correct it, but I get so much fun out of it. There were two women at an exhibition, and they were finding all the misspelled words in my etching, and I loved it.
Because they stayed and looked at the work.
Yeah,
and that's
how they got into the work. I mean, that was the relationship to the work, was finding misspelled words.
Well, then after a while, didn't you start putting words backwards and stuff
there
like
are
that?
Words. So well, in etching, you have to do everything backwards.
But you also do something forward, too. You mix it up.
Yeah, but in the process of etching, you get confused sometimes, and you get carried away. You'll spell the word the right way, and, of course, in printing, it comes out the reverse, so it comes out backwards.
But that doesn't bother you.
You just
use that
all.
As visual information and hope people enjoy it.
Yes.
Well, you talked about at the beginning that you felt many times like a boy inside a man's body, and presumably children or childlike adults looking at your paintings are drawn into them, and they feel that toy box quality.
Yeah, I like children to look at my paintings. They always like them, and that to me is important. I think children are very important critics, and if they like it, it makes me happy.
Yeah. Now, you said that you would never paint or draw the Twin Cities cityscape because they don't have an elevated transit system. Yeah. Are you that fascinated with the trains that they have to have one for you to take it on as a work?
Yeah, I like kind of...
Maybe this will be a scent of us for us to get some rapid transit that's elevated. have a Knudsen painting of the city if they do that.
There are certain tackiness to trains that I love. Like if you're in the city of Ghent in Belgium, there's marvelous streetcars. They're real tinny looking and tacky, and they look very almost oriental. And they go down the tracks, you know, clickety-clack, and they're really marvelous. I love them, and I guess that's what I like about the elevated in Chicago. They're so tenuous up there, hanging on all that steel, and the way they go down the clickety-clack, and if you're on them, you have such marvelous views of the city. And I just like that. It's like, I suppose, a person collecting toy trains and, you know, playing with them. I see that as all kind of a, you know, related
it's like
somehow.
For you, it's like a tour. Like somebody would go to Disneyland and get on a train and tour the exhibit. You get on the train and tour everything that's going on in Chicago. You look into the windows of people's homes as the train passes by. Right?
Yeah, see, I don't like amusement parks because I can get on a real train and get as much amusement as I can on in Disney World. I don't need that heightened, you know, fantasy because my fantasy is already there. I find it in the city. And
one of your paintings, you've taken inspiration from a German film called Sucker Baby, which involves trains, the subway.
Yes, it's a story about a young lady who falls in love with a train conductor, and then what ensues. I love foreign films, and that particular lithograph is kind of derived from that film very much. I was really impressed with that movie.
Okay. John also studied with two of the most famous printmakers of the 20th century, Stanley William Hayter and Mauricio Lesansky. Those people were very strong personalities. How did you maintain your individualism, and were they individualists?
They were. Of course, Mauricio Lesansky, I think, is very important and really caused the resurgence in printmaking.
Can you give us a little bit of background on each of those men as you describe your relationship to them?
Well, Mauricio Lesansky teaches printmaking, or he's retired now, at the University of Iowa, and he began the Iowa Print workshop. And I attended the university from 60 to 63, you know, close to the point when really it was really burgeoning, and of course by the time I'd gotten there it was very important. But he really brought printmaking in this country to a very high level of importance and availability to the public, and it became a media that had been, of course, it's a very old media, but came back to life again, so to speak. Many important printmakers graduated from there, went out to teach at various universities around this country and abroad, and spreading the word. And I think a lot of that had to do with Lesansky's a very important artist in his own right. And so I thought it was very important to be there. He was a very strong influence on a lot of people, and I think a very domineering type of teacher. I've always found that I kind of shied away and pull away from people like that because I think that sometimes you can become dominated to the point where your work becomes kind of kind of imitation of your teacher. And I think it's important for students to be influenced by their teachers, but I think at a point you have to say, okay, I'm going to go my own way now. I'm going to take a different road.
Does that happen immediately, or did that take a couple of
years? Because I noticed that even after I graduated, I was asking myself, how would Monsieur Lesansky solve this problem? When in fact I should be saying, well, how would John Knudsen solve this problem?
So there's a catch-22 there. It's really good to study with strong influences, but there has to be this almost like James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist, Young Man, a break. and you have to go through that whole struggle.
Cut your ties, yes.
We mentioned at the beginning of the program that you worked at Atelier 17 in Paris. Can you tell us a bit about that?
And that was with Stanley William Hayter.
Stanley William Hayter, of course, taught Lesansky. He was the 20th century printmaker, teacher of the granddaddy of all of us, I guess, and tremendous person. I liked both of the men because of their vitality. They're very energetic. Their creative vitality came through in their personality. I mean, just being by them, around them, was electricity. And it was exciting to be at both places. And I think if I got anything from, well, I did, I got a lot, but I think the most important thing I got from both of them was this tremendous creative energy that one must have to be sustained as an artist. Because being an artist is really a lonely existence. Nobody's there to tell you when to work and how to work. And most people really could care less whether you work or not. You have to keep pushing yourself. It's work just like any other kind of work, but you have to, you know, sustain yourself. And I think that they really generated that responsibility of being an artist, to me at least. And I'm proud to have been associated with both of those teachers.
Okay. You also mentioned in your lecture that you didn't like perfect passages, that wasn't mm-hmm. what you were trying to do. Like, I think you mentioned something about Rauschenberg, that he did everything so well that you didn't like it.
Yeah, I guess I don't like, people come by and say, oh, that's a wonderful subtle nuance, you know, in my painting, or that's a marvelous, color passage or something. And I don't really like people to, yes, that's important, but I think the descriptive quality of my work is more important to me rather than making pretty patches on a painting or pretty passages and so forth. And I think sometimes artists can get caught up in making this. It's a media kind of orientated painting, which I guess is wonderful. I mean, you can look at a Ensor painting, who I admire a great deal, and it's full of wonderful passages and subtle nuances, but it all comes together. It leads up to that one statement, and that is the totality of the work, not the all these little other things that are minor. I mean, when you make a painting, I always feel like making a pie. You do the crust and the apples, and you put it all together, and it's got to come out delicious totally. I mean, therefore, everything is subjected to that, to the unifying element of a work of art, not just one particular part.
Does that bring you back again to your love of rugs?
Yeah, it does. I although a rug is so totally disorganized, and of course I love that, the more disorganized and asymmetrical, the more wonderful it is, because, and I, somehow it comes together for me. I mean, if you can understand that. To me, something that's so perfectly symmetrical is utterly boring. And I mean, people from time immemorial knew that. That's why all you have to do is look at a, African sculpture or any kind of primitive work that using patterns. Most of these cultures made use of pattern. The pattern is asymmetrical. It's never perfectly symmetrical.
But back to that painting, the high school days, which has those asymmetrical lampposts, even though they are asymmetrical, they do form the painting.
Yeah, they help tie it together. They unify the painting, visual elements that tie it together.
What about your use of color, and particularly the illuminated cities? You're using bright primary colors.
Mm-hmm. As you get older, I think you get crazier. That's I think that's the only benefit of getting older. Okay, I mean, our bodies fall to pieces and, aches and pains. But the one marvelous thing we have is that we get crazier as we get older. So I find that as I get older, my craziness comes out in color. It gets wilder and wilder. And so that's probably what you're seeing is the benefits of age.
Yeah. You were saying if you wanted a perfect passage, go out and see a barn that was poorly painted or something.
I think today you'll see, for instance, especially some of the conceptual works. I mean, you could take almost anything. You could take this microphone here and isolate it in a museum, put it under a spotlight, put a abstract, obtuse title to it, and some of the major writers from the major newspapers could come in and tell us all how marvelous it was. Many people would believe it, I think. And I think that's what's happening with a lot of art today. It becomes media orientated. It's trendy, it's different, offbeat, and, I think in 10 years it will be forgotten.
You have to struggle on your work, so you just don't go around naming things art. takes you a year, perhaps, mm-hmm. to develop something? That is there highs and lows? Do you kind of like wish you never started the thing?
No, I don't. I really love the creative act of making something. I get in problems. I get in the doldrums often, and I have to fish myself out some way. But I like creative problems. I mean, I like the challenge of a problem, of a creative, of a painterly problem, or of a compositional problem. I find them challenging.
So that every time, if a painting doesn't give you a compositional problem, it almost doesn't widen your scope? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes even throw logs in the road ahead of me, so I'm very good at making obstacles for myself, because they create intellectual challenges. And, you know, some people say, why do you do that? It's so stupid. Well, because I like the solving of them.
Does that bring out you or your individualism more, the fact that you throw these log jams in there?
Yeah, I think I've always been a person who loves to make problems for myself.
Yeah, because there's only one way of solving, and it's your way.
Yeah, yeah, and find fishing my... And it's not only art, either. It can be any, even real-life problems. Yeah. I like that.
And that's why they don't like trends, because trends are like, this is what's happening, how do I go about doing it?
Yeah, I don't.
It's free from problems,
I'm
free from individuality.
Yeah, I'm suspicious of people who, you know, are totally accept my work. I'd rather have negative comments, because then I react to that more.
Do you work on one work at a time, or do you have a projection as you work on one thing? Are you thinking ahead to other projects?
I work on painting and etching at the same time. Etching's a great nighttime activity. Paintings you work on during the day, and then I'm always thinking ahead and behind of what I'm going to do next. Now, for instance, right now I'm in a state of flux because I've just gotten ready for the show. I haven't painted or touched the paintbrush in 3 weeks. I've been framing stuff, and I'm starting to go crazy. So I can't wait now to get started on the next thing. I mean, I've already got the canvas ready to go, and I'm champing at the bit.
Thanks for coming over here and sharing your ideas with us.
Okay. What I did was, at the beginning of the show, was I talked about John Knutson being somebody who is art for the individual's sake, and that art for art's sake. Art for art's sake was basically a deregulation away from the commissions of kings, queens, and the churches. And I think that it's very important that we get back to the individual and society, that the society is made up of independent people who form a community.
Hope we can have you back, and perhaps in the next few years the Twin Cities will have an L that will bring you back.
Listen, if you do, I'll be here to paint it.
John Knutson is visiting artist here at the University of Minnesota. He's a graduate of Luther College, State University of Iowa, has taught and studied around the world, and his exhibit is currently in the Studio Arts Building here at the University of Minnesota. It's up through October 21st. The Studio Arts Building is open Monday through Friday, 9 to 4. I'm Steve Benson, here with regular co-host
David Feinberg,
who is an artist and associate professor of studio arts here
painting.
At the university. Painting, yes.
As well as sculpture.
As well as sculpture, both combined.
Yeah, right.
And tomorrow at 1:30, you can join us for a special look at the upcoming dance scene in the Twin Cities with, among others, Minneapolis Star-Tribune critic Mike Steele.